Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Mackenzie Cutchell. This is Erin Cater. She'll be co-presenting with me. And we are both graduate students right now at the University of North Texas Health Science Center. We're going to be presenting a little bit of our work on the evaluation of a sex worker diversion program and some of the factors that we think might be predicting their success in treatment. We have no relationships to disclose. So to begin, Erin is going to talk to you a little bit about the background of the program.
So the Prostitution Diversion Initiative, or the PDI, is a unique program in Dallas, Texas, which is led by the Dallas Police Department. It's made up of a large cross-section of organizations to provide a comprehensive set of services and resources. Some of these organizations include the Dallas County Sheriff's Office, the Dallas County Health Department, Parkland Hospital, the courts, and over 40 social service and faith-based organizations. The PDI began in 2007 due to community concern about prostitution, and our school was asked to help evaluate the effectiveness of the program. The goal of the PDI is to divert sex street workers from the streets. They are offered an opportunity to access comprehensive inpatient and outpatient trauma-based treatment programs as an alternative to jail. While there are a few similar programs in the country, this one is unique for a few reasons. First, it is led by law enforcement. This allows access to women who would not be able to seek out treatment on their own by offering protection to the women and the organizations. The officers are able to go out onto the streets to pick up the women to bring them into the PDI. It is also unique because all the services are provided on the streets, which allows access to these services to the participants before they ever go to jail. However, because this program is so novel, we do not have a good comparison group. So one night a month, the PDI is conducted on the streets of Dallas. It consists of mobile units, as you can see in the picture, and moves to various hot spots of prostitution within Dallas. To be eligible to participate in the PDI, participants have to be a street sex worker 17 years old or older. So this diagram shows the layout of the mobile units on site. First, the participants are brought to the Dallas Police Department's mobile command post for booking and for the police to collect information on criminal activity. Next, they move to triage, where they receive a physical and psychological assessment by licensed social workers and medical personnel. This helps determine the most immediate need of the participants. They then move to the Dallas County Health Department, where they receive education about STDs. They're also provided with screening for STDs, and due to rapid testing, they are able to receive those test results that same night. They then receive a picture identification card, which is necessary in order to access other services like food stamps. And the last step is the on-site court. So here the on-site judge accepts the plea from the defendant, the woman, and if she pleads no contest or guilty, the judge then evaluates the social service recommendations and can issue a court order for the participant to follow these recommendations. So at the end of the night, depending on the charge, the woman can choose to go into treatment instead of going to jail. So the last step, all the participants are either sent to jail or are diverted into a treatment center in Dallas. To date, there have been 858 participants in the PDI program. 55% have self-reported having a mental health condition, and 79% have self-reported drug or alcohol use. Many of these participants have co-occurring or comorbid disorders, which is the presence of both a mental health disorder and a substance use disorder. Women who are diverted on the night of the PDI are enrolled in a treatment center in Dallas, which employs trauma-informed and holistic treatment methods. These methods emphasize treating the whole person, and comorbid disorders are treated simultaneously. In this disadvantaged population, with high rates of mental health conditions and severe substance use disorders, trauma-informed treatment has been found to be more effective. Now Mackenzie will discuss our research, which we did to help evaluate the effectiveness of this program.
Thank you, Erin. Okay, so the data that we used to begin the analysis was obtained actually directly from Homeward Bound Treatment Center in Dallas. And when they go here, the PDI women actually receive the exact same inpatient treatment as women who go into this treatment center through means other than the diversion. So the first question that we wanted to answer is, are these PDI women as successful in completing this inpatient treatment as the non-PDI women? Now, evaluating the effectiveness of the program is not a simple task because success in inpatient treatment is influenced by many factors. For example, literature shows that socio-demographic factors are associated with dropping out of substance abuse treatment, particularly in women. Specifically, King's study in 2004 found African American women to be 5 times as likely to drop out of inpatient treatment as white women, Furthermore, King also found that socioeconomic factors, such as homelessness, may also influence success in treatment for substance abuse. With that in mind, we wanted to look at the demographic differences between our two populations and assess whether these factors might be what's influencing the differences in success in treatment. So for the evaluation, we used a cohort study design as we selected our study participants based on exposure status. And our sample population was all the women in treatment at Home or Bound Treatment Center during 2009. The exposure of interest was being contacted through the Prostitute Diversion Initiative, and we had 27 in the exposed group and 323 in the unexposed group. The outcome of interest was failure to complete inpatient treatment. This completion status was obtained from the treatment charts at Home or Bound. So this is where it got complicated for us, because how do you measure treatment success? It's difficult to decide what the standard is for being considered successful in inpatient treatment. So what we decided to use was what Home or Bound defines as the short-term treatment success indicators. The first of these indicators of the completion is the completion of the recommended time in inpatient facility. This is measured by comparing the recommended length of stay given by the clinician at the beginning during the screening, and then we compared that to the admission and discharge dates to see if they stayed as long as they were prescribed to stay. And once again, all of this information was obtained through the treatment charts. In addition to this prescribed length of stay, each client is also given a treatment plan, and it contains specific tasks that they are supposed to complete before their discharge date. These include a goodbye letter to their drug of choice, a personal life history that they write, also the completion of at least 3 of 12 steps in a 12-step program, and a detailed relapse prevention program. Completion and non-completion of each task is recorded in the client's paper medical record. If they complete 3 out of 5 of the treatment tasks by their discharge date, they're considered successfully treated and they receive a certificate of treatment completion. So in comparing the initial completion rates between unexposed and exposed groups, we found that in the PDI group, 37% completed treatment and 63% failed to complete treatment. In the non-PDI group, 67% completed and 33% failed to complete. Keep in mind that these initial completion rates don't tell the whole story of the effectiveness of the PDI program. So to further examine the characteristics of these populations and how that might be affecting their success in treatment, we use stratified analysis to obtain a risk estimate and to control for demographic factors. We also constructed a logistic model, but with a sample size of 27, it was very unstable, very inconclusive, so those are not the estimates that we used. So this first table compares the demographic makeup of the two populations. As you can see, racial composition is very different between the two groups. The majority of the PDI population is Black, while the majority of the non-PDI population is white. Also, based on this demographic distribution and the small numbers that you see in the other races, we dichotomized the race variable into white and non-white for the remainder of the analysis. The chi-square test for independence, p-value, shows that the difference in race between these two populations is statistically significant. The other factors we examined, which were age, education, and homelessness, were not statistically significant between the two groups, but we did see some small differences. So in our analysis, as I mentioned, the outcome of interest we considered was failure to complete treatment. We examined the association between demographic factors and failure to complete first. So as you can see in the relative risks displayed in this table, in the overall study population, including PDI and non-PDI, each factor did have an association with treatment failure. When we stratified these relative risks by the diversion status, we saw some very interesting results. The data suggest that demographic factors influence treatment success differently between the two groups. In PDI women, minority women are more likely to complete treatment, whereas in the non-PDI women, minority women are less likely to complete treatment. We also examined the association between PDI status and failure to complete. The unadjusted relative risk that we found was 1.95. So when demographic factors are not controlled for, PDI women were 95% more likely to drop out of inpatient treatment before completing. We suspect that this increased risk may be due to the fact that PDI women are very compromised and have likely experienced trauma. Literature indicates that sexual and physical trauma are very closely related to outcomes in substance abuse treatment. Next, we stratify this association of the PDI status on failure to complete by each demographic factor. And this table shows the relative risk of non-completion between PDI and non-PDI, stratified by the demographic factors. And once again, we saw large differences in the estimates between the estimates and the race strata. Among whites, the relative risk of failure to complete associated with PDI status is 2.66. Among non-whites, this relative risk was 1.7. Okay, so I'd like to discuss just a few of our key findings. First, we found that demographic factors are in fact associated with treatment success in our study population. Furthermore, we found that the demographic makeup of the two groups was very different. We saw a statistically significant difference between the two groups in race. The proportion of PDI women who complete treatment is lower than that of non-PDI women. However, within the PDI population in treatment, minority women actually appear to be more successful than white women. This was very unexpected, as if you'll remember the King's study that I mentioned, in that population, black women were much less likely to complete treatment. So this data suggests that the PDI program might be reaching a population of women that might not otherwise have access to treatment. The difference in race proportion seems to indicate that the PDI population is not the same population that's typically being admitted to substance abuse treatment. The PDI population is primarily minority women who are very compromised and disadvantaged. This population typically sees very low rates of treatment completion. However, within the PDI group, these women are having success in treatment. We did have quite a few limitations in our study. First of all, just in defining treatment success, that is subjective. So we did use the short-term success indicators as a measure of treatment success, but it might be a good idea to explore other measures, possibly long-term success indicators, or other measures that might be better indicators of true success. Also, this is pilot data, so small sample size with the 27 PDI women. And much of the data was self-reported, such as the homeless status and the education status, so the fact that we didn't see a difference in those might be due to that. Also, as Erin mentioned, this program is novel. The literature for sex worker diversions is sparse, so it's challenging to see how our results might compare to results elsewhere. It's also challenging to find a true comparison group to compare treatment outcomes of this PDI population. So what is the significance of these findings? There are a few sex worker diversion programs that currently exist across the United States. This evaluation can help to inform these existing programs and future programs regarding this underserved and understudied population. One of the things that we've learned from the evaluation of the PDI is the importance of law enforcement leadership. As Erin mentioned, this is what sets the PDI program apart from other sex worker diversion programs, and it's one of the keys to its success. Law enforcement offers protection for the health organizations on the street and allows them to access these women that they would not otherwise have access to. Our findings can also help future programs gain knowledge of the disadvantaged population. Understanding how they are different from other women in treatment and seeing where they are successful in treatment can help inform treatment centers on how to best meet their needs when they do come in through these diversions. Thank you.
This is a really interesting talk, but that flow chart you show, it looks like, will they eventually end up in jail if they don't go into the program? So is there a selection bias that they're willing to go into the program, not because they want to be in treatment, but because they're trying to avoid jail?
You want to answer that one?
Sure. All the women that are brought to the PDI, or most of the women that are brought to the PDI, are arrested. That's why they are brought in. But and not all of them are eligible to be diverted. It depends on their charge. So the ones that are eligible, it could cause some selection bias because they're given the option of going into treatment or going to jail. So, I mean, that is the limitation.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, I mean, it's a wonderful program. I just wouldn't hold yourself to a standard that you would expect them to have in space.
Right. That's why the 37% should not be viewed as unsuccessful at all, because these are women that would not even have gotten there in the first place. So seeing this 37% is a really good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the term diversion. What are they being diverted from? Yeah. Once they're cured of their substance abuse, are they now back on the streets sober?
The goal of the program is that they wouldn't be back on the street, you know, that they would, there's a programming combination called New Life Opportunities, and they hope that they will come through the program and be able to start a new life outside, away from prostitution.
Dr.
Hampton is here. Excellent. I guess we're not as familiar with the PDI program as she is, and that might be something to ask her about afterwards. or right now.
So at this time, we've got just a little under 15 minutes. I thought if we had the panel assembled, we could throw out some topics. Any of you who are working on similar studies or similar work may want to share. So let's try to make this a more interactive and Socratic discussion. So does anybody on the panel first have a comment about somebody else's work? Please.
Yeah, I actually have a question about the last presentation. I'm writing my dissertation on women in prostitution, actually, and I'm thinking in terms of the self-selecting sample tool. I understand there's a lot of relational factors and complications that go into even being in prostitution. So I was wondering if there was a component of the program that addressed relational factors to sort of help with the relational assessment after the program.
Did everybody hear the question? Okay, so she asked, was there a relationship looking at long-term success and if there's a carry-on, correct, pretty much, with the work? If not, stand up and speak it louder, because I don't think everybody in the back can hear you.
That sounded a lot fancier than what I asked. Well, I was just thinking about the relational complexities of being involved in prostitution and not always necessarily feeling like one is master of their own destiny. And
good point.
So, even I imagine there might be a lot of fear maybe choosing the option of going into this program as opposed to going to jail or just a larger relational factor.
Kinsey and Erin, can you speak to that and try to project? We don't have a portable microphone, I'm afraid.
It is definitely an issue that we have to talk about. I'm not sure really how to address the question. It's not something that we looked at in our study, but it is something that we've discussed in looking at the program. But it is a huge determining factor, just an issue of their safety and whether they're afraid. And that's what we discussed with the importance of law enforcement leadership, is that they can come in and are protected to access those services where they may not be able. Oh,
voila.
With the law enforcement leadership, we've discussed how the women have the safety to come access these services and get trusted and things like that, where otherwise they may be living in fear and not able to do things like that.
And just to follow up on that, do you have any differences between people who either choose jail or choose to, I guess, go to court instead of being diverted? Or do you know the demographic differences between those two populations?
Do we have any information?
We didn't look at that in our study, but that information is available.
So the answer that they were saying is no. Never.
We didn't look at it. The information is available if we did want to look at it later.
So, please.
Question for, I get your names, I'm sorry, for the Burpas, and then
Sure.
I understand Burpas, and actually refer to me that just called around on the Burpas. The thing that I'm wondering is, there are modules and things like that within each of the states, they roll in and they roll out year to year. Is there any, and they are structured, but is there any structure in getting them into some of these modules, like this one that you discussed, or one, say, on LGBT, actually within the purpose to stay there, to get population
data? Okay, so I'm going to answer this in several ways. One is, we've been having recent discussions because funding is being pulled for the modules because of the state lost funding well as federal funding. So what we have been talking about recently was coordinating the surveys so the modules are all given at the same time. But we're also trying to figure out ways to create the long-term sustainable funding. And that's the difficulty, creating sustainable funding when all the funding's been cut. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think what it is trying to give these all, I mean, even if we can only give them every 5 years, if we give them all at the same time, then you can look at
benchmark.
Exactly. So it would be more cost effective to do what you're saying. And I'm trying to get that into everyone's head that, you know, doing it once every 5 years where all these modules are given is better than not.
Other questions from the audience?
I'm just going to comment one other thing on their piece. So, you know, a 12-step program is what I consider social support.
Yes.
And, you know, of course, sex workers report many higher, you know, much higher rates of these adverse, childhood experiences. So it's, I think social support is such an undervalued intervention. And I don't know if other people have things to say about that. Improving social support, because someone said, what happens to these people after they go through the treatment? I think the goal should be get them into a social support network that is sustainable and can keep them off the streets.
I think
sustainability
is key. Mm-hmm. Clearly, and I'm not dinging you guys, there's definitely some interest bias with regard to how they're selected, but I understand that because you are attempting to do a better good than you are in that regard. So yes, you would have a very difficult time finding a true max control group. So I commend you for doing that. Chair Presidents, I'd like to ask Michelle one question. When I look at the epidemiological data that you provided, comparing any DSM-IV diagnosis in the Arab world versus the United States, clearly there's a marked difference. I've worked with Pakistanis for a number of years doing a variety of research projects, and I know culturally it's a great stigma to admit that you have any sort of underlying mental condition. Do you feel like the numbers that you reported could be skewed or biased because of those cultural beliefs and or fears of being seen as potentially?
I think it's definitely possible. Although the methodology, the way that it was conducted is people aren't asked, do you have this disorder, do you not have this disorder, or it's not even like the rates of people who present to a clinic for symptoms. It was like population survey based, going out of the community.
That was my next question.
So, I think it helps mitigate some of it.
Sure.
But we're still, I think, an element of that trickles down to the specific questions of asking about specific symptoms. So I think it's just something helpful.
One of the audience asked about cultural connotation that someone is more entrenched in the culture and it's more conservative, whereas a young person may have a little more, let's say, psychosocial flexibility and change. You know, we in the United States, we see what's going on overseas, and we have concerns. My stress levels up a little. But your comment in return was that you felt like the people who live there now don't feel that same sense of change?
I think it really depends. I feel like there's a very, I think a predominant feeling, if you're not in a war zone, then you're not feeling too good about it, but I think the predominant sense of the least right now is a lot of anticipation mixed with a lot of anxiety. Because in certain areas, it's like the devil, you know, is better than the devil that you know. Is that the expression? But I did want to, the question of flexibility is an interesting one to me too, because in some ways being rooted in a tradition is very comforting and very stabilizing. And so for younger people who have less of that, it actually may be more destabilizing in this certain situation. And one thing that I wanted to add about culture bound syndrome is that it's not just like what do you see in the Arab world that you might not see other places, but even for example, DSM-IV disorders that you can't, that manifest differently or not applicable to the Arab world as in subculture. Like for example, agoraphobia. In certain areas in Saudi Arabia, if you're a woman, you're not really allowed to leave the house. Is that agoraphobia? Probably not. So that's a cultural.
Do we have other questions for our panelists?
Yeah.
and you said that four from stand up could actually make everyone that my when I present, excuse me, when I moderate stand up. So also apologies for that not standing earlier. But anyway, you mentioned about older and younger and those who in the tradition and having that stability, but yet there's that you mentioned those who are younger. And I apologize if I didn't see this or hear it when you were commenting. Do you find that, and when you were looking at it, that those who are younger have more DSM-4 diagnoses versus the old? Or do you see it pretty much the same across the board? And this is, of course, for the air, for those countries that you mentioned.
I'm sure I have that data broken down somewhere. I don't have it over the top of my head.
So have there been, have you found data that have looked at the countries that you've looked at and looking at, I don't really like this term, but I guess it's the best one to use, sexual minorities and gender minorities within those countries and psychiatric disorders or mental health issues with those particular subpopulations in those countries? That'd be very interesting to know if there have been data.
That is a great question. I haven't found data on sexual minorities. I imagine the reality is not very easy at the moment for sexual minorities in the Arab world. But for gender minorities, there, I think the breakdown of disorder of marriage a little bit how it would happen actually in the United States.
Okay.
So higher on inside sort of higher on the disorders, and then the externalizing disorders that are substance use disorders definitely higher in those.
Well, we've got maybe one time for one more question, and I'd like to just summarize some of the remarks that we've seen. Anybody else? No? Okay. Just out of curiosity, how many in here are epidemiologists or work in epidemiology or work with an epidemiologist? Good. All right. How many of you would like to be turned in to an epidemiologist? Okay, a good one. Okay, you know, we've heard some really wonderful things, and I think what we've heard across the board is, you know, mental health is a problem, not just in the United States, but elsewhere. Epidemiologists do play a role in working within these groups and helping the teams to understand the scope, breadth, severity of it. And I believe firmly that epidemiology is an action-oriented science, that we as epidemiologists or those who work with epidemiologists need to be in the field. We can't just sit in our offices. We need to be part of a participatory team and making sure that we are helping the people in the street who need us. So we started this conversation today with a quick review of what we've seen on the streets in San Francisco. Now you've heard things about very vulnerable population of prostitutes, sex workers, your work with children, and yours with sex abuse, and your discussion about mental health issues in Arab nations. I think what we should take home as epidemiologists when we leave today is how can we, as epidemiology, help ameliorate or attenuate the mental health issues in our field. So thank you for attending. Great panel.